Hello and welcome to our special Pollinator Week podcast episode. We're talking all things pollinators and native plants. My name is Franny Jurdy with the Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation District. I'm the urban conservationist, and I'm super happy to welcome Heather Holm as our guest speaker, who is a pollinator conservationist and award-winning author of several books dedicated to pollinator identification and their relationship with native plants. Thank you so much for joining me today, Heather.
Oh, thanks, Franny. Great to be here.
And I'm going to let you introduce yourself, Heather, and maybe give a little background on how you got started in pollinator conservation.
Sure, thanks. I got started and interested in pollinators probably about 18 years ago, and really my transition into insects is what I call it. Really, I started with the plant world and just became absolutely fascinated by the insect diversity and specifically pollinators that I would see while working in native landscapes. Mm-hmm. And then comparing that with, you know, working in more traditional landscapes, the difference was, to me, was astounding. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I always say sent me down the insect rabbit hole. And then I never came out. But I think at the time there was real value to help bridge those two disciplines, you know, the pollinator folks and the plant folks. So yeah. I feel like I straddle both worlds, but trying to make those connections.
Absolutely. Very cool. And so it is National Pollinator Week, which was started to raise awareness for pollinators. Like you said, every week should be Pollinator Week, which I totally agree. And the Sherburne SWCD is doing some activities and educational events geared toward pollinator education, which includes this podcast. And so I kind of wanted to kick things off with the basics. So do you kind of want to explain what exactly is a pollinator? Why are they so important? Why do we have this national week dedicated to education for pollinators?
Sure. So the really basic definition of a pollinator is it's some kind of organism that is moving pollen from one flower to the next and resulting in pollination. So here in Minnesota, we largely focus on insects. They're primary pollinators of plants that require some kind of help. But of course, many of our plants use wind or some, mm-hmm. in rare cases, water to move their pollen. So we celebrate pollinators and, you know, talk about them being really important in the context of humans. Pollinators, mm-hmm. are pollinating some of the food that we rely on to consume ourselves. But for you and me, Franny, who are looking at it from more of a perhaps conservation or natural world standpoint, pollinators are critical for pollinating plants so that they obviously will produce seed and continue reproducing and keeping our landscapes diverse and abundant and resilient. So mm-hmm. they really are really important. But most people focus on, you know, that what's in it for me.
Right.
So you're, yeah. getting some pollination from the food that we eat too.
Right. Because, yeah, there's that saying, what, every three bites of food is thanks to a pollinator. And on top of that, like, it, you know, they allow the production of the wild fruits and nuts and seeds that wildlife just did nature depend on too. So it's important for everybody, for people, animals alike.
Absolutely. They're sort of the native plants and the pollinators are forming that really, mm-hmm. critical foundation of, mm-hmm. you know, then what sits on top of that is, of course, all those interactions, like the examples you just gave.
Yeah. And so I think most people, when they hear the word pollinator, they probably think of maybe two things, which one of is the honeybee, and, you know, everybody hears about colony collapse disorder, so they like are aware of kind of pollinator plights and things like that, or they've probably heard of the monarch butterfly, like the poster child for pollinator conservation, such a well-recognized pollinator species. But I love seeing people's reactions when they hear all of the other pollinators that exist, especially just the number of native bees that are in Minnesota. So do you want to kind of go over how many native bees we have in Minnesota and how they differ from the honeybee, the bee that everybody knows about?
Sure. So the number is getting, it's sort of creeping up month by month, all the great entomologists doing some pretty extensive surveys in all of our Minnesota counties. So to my knowledge, we're just shy of 500 native bee species in Minnesota.
Awesome.
So that's an astounding number. As you said, most people think maybe can name two or three kinds of bees, like a honeybee, a bumblebee, and maybe a mason bee or something, right?
Yep.
But there's this amazing diversity out there, and you know, many different genera, and you know, hundreds of species. So once you start looking, it's not hard to see and to observe, you know, a good diversity even in a small urban garden. It's just taking the time to look, right?
And most of our native bees are solitary, correct?
Oh, yes. Part two of the question.
Yes.
Yes, they are. So approximately 90% have solitary nests. And so what that means is a single female bee actively looks for a place to nest, establishes a nesting site either in the ground or above ground. And then she does all the work to do that pollen and nectar collection from flowers and take that back to the nest and make little pollen and nectar provisions and lays eggs, a single egg on each little pollen provision. So that is a very different model than, as you said, honeybees, right? Honeybees are highly social, 10 to 50,000 bees living in a managed hive here in Minnesota. So our bees, our native bees, for the most part, are single mothers, and they have a pretty short period of time, 4 to 5 weeks, to do all that work of nest establishment and provisioning and egg laying. And then they don't see their offspring turn into adults. Like they perish and leave their offspring to develop in the nest for the next typically 11 months. And then their offspring come out at the same time that they came out. And it's all different depending on what species it may be. So
So you say they're active for a pretty short time frame, which is pretty remarkable. And so, since there are so many different kinds of bees, are there different time frames where they're all active? So you need to think about providing plants for the early emerging bees and then the late emerging bees.
Yes, absolutely. So you think of that growing season in Minnesota starting maybe some years, mid-April, right?
Yep.
Into the 1st of October, and overlapping that time frame are the 500 species. So, and each, the solitary ones, again, having a 4 or 5 week window. And so, yes, you see patterns once you start to learn some of the basic bees. You'll see many in the genus Andrena in the spring. That's the mining bees. And many of those species are active when we have woodland wildflowers blooming, some of the first native shrubs. And then we get into this time of year, kind of the shoulder season, where we're transitioning from spring to summer. And pretty soon, a whole different suite of solitary bees will be coming out and visiting some of those prairie plants, the plants in the aster family. So sometimes I anticipate seeing a specific bee genus based on when a plant blooms. So, yeah, Golden Alexanders is usually the flowering of that plant coincides with when the bees in the genus Hylaeus, also called yellow-faced bees or masked bees. That's when I typically see them come out. So it's this wonderful sort of not only plant phenology, as you said, you know, the having things bloom continuously through the growing season, but how the bees are associating with that and how that plays out.
So, you know, our, like you kind of mentioned, our spring can kind of fluctuate on when it decides to turn up unchanged from winter.
Yeah.
Does that affect, you know, when the bees' emergence, or does that, do they sometimes emerge and things aren't quite ready? Is that having an impact on their populations?
Absolutely. The earliest emerging solitary bees is a type of cellophane bee. And in some years, the males, which come out first before the females in a solitary nest, they can come out at the end of March here in the metro area. Ooh. So now think about our last 4 or 5 years. We've had freak snowstorms, or maybe normal April snowstorms.
Yeah.
So in some cases, the females have already started a nest, and then they have to sit there in their nest burrows and wait for warmer temperatures in order to go out and forage. So they seem to have evolved with that going on.
Yeah.
But bumblebees, you know, the new queens come out of hibernation. The fluctuating temperatures like that could impact them if they don't have enough food resources. They may sort of go back into a pseudo hibernation and wait it out.
Mm.
But just with the abnormal patterns, I'm sure it's impacting a number of types of bees.
Interesting. And so you also have a book on wasps, native wasps. And that's like, I hear so much about bees and I listen to a lot of talks about bees, but I don't hear a ton about native wasps, but I definitely see them flying around when I'm, you know, looking at flowers. Can you kind of talk about, because I feel like whenever anybody hears wasp, they just assume, you know, the things that are attacking their picnic when they're having their fruit juices and watermelon, and they're really aggressive. Are native wasps kind of similar to native bees, that they're solitary and not necessarily as aggressive as some of those introduced species?
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of a similar breakdown. So most wasps are, if they're nest building, are solitary, and they're out in the landscape doing their thing. It's pretty uncommon for someone to get stung by a solitary wasp. And for the most part, they get sort of passed off as flies or maybe some kind of bee. And but they, again, what we talked about with that seasonal phenology and short lifespan, that applies to the vast majority of wasps. So people tend to have those negative interactions with that very small minority, especially here in Minnesota, that are social. And so the social wasps are building nests made of paper, and they just have a higher propensity to defend that nest because it's a social nest. And that is also the case with bees.
Right.
You know, a honeybee colony is more likely to be defended than a solitary bee nest. So.
Yeah,
more at stake in a sense.
Right. And wasps, they aren't necessarily collecting pollen like bees are, right? Do they feed their young insects or something, or do they feed them pollen?
Not in Minnesota, but there are some rare they occur in Western U.S. that are pollen wasps, and they actually are sort of like bees where they do collect pollen, and that's the primary food they provide for their offspring. But our wasps in Minnesota are hunting various types of insects or spiders, and that's what they cache inside of a prepared cell. They also have a pretty high degree of specialization. So a solitary wasp is only going to hunt insect from a certain family, or more narrowly, a single genus. So it's really amazing how that plays out on the ground, because some really like to nest in bare, open, sandy conditions, and that you would think, oh, they're competing with each other. But in fact, each of those females of a different genus are out hunting different insects. So there isn't that competition for food resource overlap.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So are they some wasps going after what people would consider pests in their garden?
Absolutely. So our native paper wasps, they hunt a lot of caterpillars, and they've been shown to be really beneficial around vegetable gardens. So they'll hunt like the cabbage looper, caterpillar, tomato hornworms, which are more prevalent south of Minnesota, but they can really help keep some of those plant pest populations in control. There's a solitary sand wasp species that now has sort of, it hunts true bugs, and it also is now hunting the brown marmorated stink bug. So, so it does, sometimes there's a switch. If the insect that they specialize on belongs to a certain insect family, they may start hunting some of those introduced insects in that same family. So that's kind of interesting and helpful.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Everybody heard that. Wasps are good for your vegetable gardens.
Yep. That's their, I would say that's their most important ecosystem service they provide is pest population control. But
yeah,
circling back to the flowers, where does that fall in with wasps? They're nectar feeders. So in addition to looking for flower nectar, which is, you know, sugary carbohydrate, they will also look for aphid honeydew, which is the waste of plant feeding insects. So they look for sugary substances like that. But while they're visiting flowers, some pollination can occur, of course.
So recently, you know, there's been a lot of legislation on providing funding that actually supports residential pollinator habitat, which is super encouraging to see. How important is it to have like every yard with pollinator habitat, or maybe just in a neighborhood with pollinator habitat, especially like in small city lots? Like, is that going to make an impact by any means?
I firmly believe so. I mean, I still say if you plant it, they will come. And then if you work with your neighbors and create a connection of small habitat through an urban environment, then you're allowing for these pollinating species to move well through the neighborhood, providing the right number of resources that they may need. So I often call them little gas stations, right? If you have a gas station and then your neighbor three doors down has a gas station, you're really sort of helping those local pollinator populations.
I love that analogy.
Yeah. And you think about the 500 species we have in Minnesota. Some are super tiny. Franny, you and I were looking at bees a couple of weeks ago, but some are, you know, the quarter of the length of your baby fingernail.
Yeah.
So those species aren't flying very far. And that's why the small patches where there's viable nesting habitat can really help support some commonly occurring urban bees. But yeah, so I think every little bit does help.
Yeah, and that's a good point to make about their flying radius. I don't know. I don't think that's something most people think about. Do you know what like the shortest distance is that a bee will travel from its nest to provision and feed and things?
I can only guess. I think, you know, they've put little radio transponders on big bumblebees and because they can glue them on there and they won't fall off. But
yeah,
for those little tiny ones, I don't think that's possible.
Sure.
But in general, it's just their physical size will usually dictate how far they can fly. So tiny, tiny species, you know, 100, 200 yards, bumblebees, a mile or maybe more if they really have to.
Yeah.
So, and then anything in between that with the different size bees. So,
200 yards is not a very far distance. So having those little gas stations is definitely going to be important for those bees. Absolutely. So talking about native plants, we said the word native plants a few times. Maybe we should clarify exactly what a native plant is and why we're trying to plant these to help our pollinators, like our native bees and butterflies.
Sure. So native plant, I guess people have different definitions, but in general, it's a plant that has evolved in a certain region or place without human introduction. And so that's generally the very general definition. Maybe you have some add-ons to that, Franny, but
no, that was pretty, for the basic definition, that was pretty good.
Yeah, so the connection between native plants and these pollinators is a long sort of evolutionary history. What many people aren't aware of, that 20% of the 500 native bee species that occur in Minnesota actually specialize on native plants. So that means a female bee who's a solitary bee just collects pollen from a certain kind of plant. It could be a single plant genus, or maybe a handful of plant genera that belong to the same family. So that's one of the reasons why native plants are important, even in small urban gardens. You can support some of these somewhat common, but often uncommon or rare specialist bees.
Yeah. And so I get asked from people if they could use native cultivars or nativars. And those are a little different than straight native plants. Do you know if, like, the, you know, nectar and pollen content is different in native cultivars? Has there been documented study on whether they're as beneficial as a straight native plant?
There has been some research. Annie White, University of Vermont, kicked off some initial sort of comparative research between a straight native plant species and a cultivar. And she looked at nectar production and then visitation. And most of the natives, I believe, except for one, I think it was a type of culver's root, had a higher visitation rate than the cultivar. Doug Tallamy and some research at Mount Cuba have sort of built on that. And most of the time, the native straight native species is preferred. Doug Tallamy also looked at the cultivars that are a change in foliage color.
Oh, sure.
And he found that, so for the caterpillars, the butterfly and moth larvae are less likely to consume those foliage plants that have a foliage color change.
Right.
For when I put my sort of hat on and looking at the initial work, because there are very few plants, if you think of all the different plants they could do a study on. I don't think any of the research to date has looked at pollen production or quality of the pollen in cultivars versus straight species. In general, I just tell people, try as best as you can to plant the straight species.
Yeah.
If it's been selected for a crazy different flower color or double petals, avoid those.
Yeah.
But if it's a selection that's maybe just shorter than the straight species, in general, I don't think there's as many changes to those floral resources. So
okay. Well, that's good to know. Yeah.
But I think more research is needed on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And because I know some people are a little hesitant on using native species just because they're unfamiliar with them. You can't really find them. It's starting to become a little easier to find them in, you know, conventional garden centers. They're starting to have them available. So there's that, but also people tend to think they spread like crazy and can get a little aggressive. So the cultivars that are labeled kind of more well-behaved, I feel like that's a good stepping stone to get homeowners started with native plants, to at least get them a little familiar, and then maybe they can branch out from there. So like you said, just do your best, start somewhere. Right. That's better than nothing, for sure.
Yeah. And you can imagine if the person doing the shopping, the consumer, doesn't have any idea about plants, it'd just be overwhelming, right? Trying to figure out what is a cultivar, what isn't. If you went to maybe a nursery that wasn't specializing in native plants, it's a lot to navigate, I have to say.
Yeah, it definitely is. And we're super lucky in Minnesota, and especially the area I work in, Sherburne County, there's quite a few native nurseries that folks can just go walk in and peruse what the options are. Staff is always super helpful. So it's, like I said, it's just becoming easier and easier to be able to incorporate native plants into your landscaping, which is just super great to see. So for native plants, if you could tell someone like three or four species that would just be essential, maybe because they're great for a wide variety of different pollinators, or maybe there's this plant that's just, there's just not enough of it for a specialist. What three or four plants would you recommend every homeowner try to have in their pollinator garden? I know that's a really hard one because there's so many great plants out there.
That is a hard one. Well, one of the top plants for specialists, which is a little more difficult for homeowners to grow in a garden, is willows.
Oh, sure.
Although there is a nice prairie willow that is, you know, grows in drier conditions, but you'd have to go to a native plant nursery to find that.
Yes.
But willow, just keep in mind that willows are really important, even though you may not be able to plant one. And I would say other spring flowering shrubs such as dogwoods, they also support specialists. And the nice thing here in Minnesota is we have, several species to choose from, and each one sort of thrives in different growing conditions. So, and then I'm moving through the growing season here. I'd say 2 weeks ago, any plant in the native plant in the carrot or pea family would be important. Okay. Golden Alexanders or the wild white indigo or wild lupins, those are in the pea family. Those are really important and good nutritional plants for native bees. And then in the summer, make sure you have at least one species of milkweed. So milkweeds are just offering nectar, but a really wide diversity of flower visiting insects rely on milkweed. And of course, it's a host plant for the monarch. And then I'm going over three and four.
That's okay. You keep going.
And then late summer, fall, any plant in the aster family. So you can't go wrong having at least a couple of species of asters and goldenrods. So that gets you through into late August into October. So we have amazing selection of those two plants to choose from. So avoid there's a few that are aggressive, such as Canada goldenrod, but it's typically not available for sale. So
that's very true. Yep. Well, I like that list. Those are really good species to think about. I work a lot with lakeshore owners, and so I always try to encourage them to put willow on their shoreline. It's difficult sometimes because people are really worried about having their view to the lake, but I can usually tell them to keep it off to the side, and you're doing a really good job of stabilizing your shore and then providing great pollinator habitat. So keep working at it.
That's one of my favorite things to do in the spring is go and sit next to a patch of willows that's blooming. It's just literally a hive of activity of the number of bees that go to willow.
Oh, that's fun. So the first podcast that we did was talking about sustainable lawn care, which is not something that we work a lot with as conservation districts, but it's kind of becoming an untapped area of conservation opportunity. And one of the things we talked about was like lawn alternatives and pollinator friendly lawns, bee lawns, which usually don't have native species in them because it's hard to find native species that can withstand, you know, the typical lawn care. But I know the U of M and the bee lab have worked really hard to put together these bee-friendly mixes. Do you see, like, is there decent forage of even native bees on these bee lawns in, like, residential settings?
Yeah, I would say it probably depends. What I've heard, I've talked to some organic lawn care companies and people who are helping to install bee lawns. The seed mixes usually have at least three species, and as you mentioned, the standard one is the primary plant is Dutch white clover, which is not native. And over time, usually the other couple of species sort of disappear, and Dutch white clover will dominate. So that's just what, from a diversity standpoint, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Not the best situation.
Right.
But I know Twin Cities Seed, who are they are trying to work on all native bee lawn seed mixes. So that may include the prunella and perhaps some asters that can tolerate mowing and maybe the native yarrow.
Okay.
So that is in the pipeline. I've also heard of, you know, plant geeks just experimenting with frequency and height of mowing and plugging in some low growing natives such as wild strawberry.
Yeah.
You know, prairie smoke. There's a number of things I think if we're not managing our lawn as intensively.
Yeah.
Violets, of course, pussy toes, depending on your soil, that you could augment a lawn with some flowering plants. But they generally have to think of them still as being a low diversity.
Yeah.
My gut is just tear out a bit of turf grass and put in a higher diversity planting instead, if you can.
Yeah, that's a good recommendation. And in Sherburne County, I mean, you've been there, you know, it's basically a sandbox.
Yeah.
So really great prairie habitat, not so great for lawns. So your recommendation of just setting aside an area to dedicate for pollinator habitat instead of trying to work with the lawn, it's very difficult. So that's probably a better way to go, and you can get better quality plants for sure. But I like to throw that out as an option for folks that they just maybe don't have the space and they just really want to maintain their lawn for recreation. They have kids or dogs or whatever. That's still, again, better than nothing. And it's maybe a baby step to something more down the line.
Right. And the other benefit, of course, is it's changing the mindset of lawn maintenance, right?
Less, absolutely,
fewer chemical inputs, thinking of it as more of a not watering as much, mowing less, mowing higher, thinking about the actual grass that you have, selecting fescues that are more drought tolerant. So it's opening different doors of lawn management, I think, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, for sure. Because especially just having that mindset that it's okay to have flowers in your grass so you don't need to spray a bunch of chemicals to try to get rid of those flowers. They're doing something. So you work on, in the metro area, you work on a city-owned lot. How did this start? I want you to explain this. I haven't heard the full story of...
Oh, yeah, I do a lot of social media postings about what I find in the lot, right? But most of my volunteer time, I am doing ecological restoration volunteer work in my city. So, and that includes things like the corner lot, which I'll talk about, or larger, you know, park projects and restorations. But the corner lot is just down the street in my neighborhood. It was a city-owned lot. It still is. And my city has lots that they call outlots, which were deemed unbuildable, whether it was because there was a power line or it wasn't large enough for a house. And so that's what the corner lot is. It's just shy of a half acre. And it has a power line. It also had the power line footprint was the footprint of the Minneapolis to Lake Minnetonka streetcar. So it has this really interesting history of what we call not so great land use. and so that lot became a sort of unmanaged and filled up with Siberian elm and buckthorn and every other invasive you can think of.
Yep.
And I said to my husband, I can't drive by that lot anymore. we need to do something about it. It's just hideous. And so approached the watershed, talked to the city. We did get a small grant from our watershed, Nine Mile Creek, and that helped pay for removal of the big invasive trees. And then it was largely a neighborhood volunteer effort to take out the invasive species and replant. So, so that started in the fall of 2015. And then after that initial volunteer effort, it's largely been my husband and I that have been maintaining it and watching it and seeing how it evolves. And so it's sort of my little science project. I've been documenting pollinators and, you know, the change over time. And it's just pretty fascinating what you can do even with a severely degraded site and turn it around with some effort. So
how could you estimate how many native plants are in that site now?
Yeah, I have a list. So we started with only, you know, 5 native woody species were present on site before we started. And one of those was sumac and cottonwood and box elder. So, you know, not the most desirable from a restoration standpoint. And I think we're over 250 plant species.
Wow.
So it's this really nice mix of a hot, sunny edge. So we have, you know, seeded in prairie plants and then a shadier, sedgy kind of part shade middle section, and then the back section has a pond, and that's where the watershed was interested. It's a holding pond.
Yeah.
So we did a full shoreline planting and to help improve the water quality. So a really nice mix of plants.
Yeah. So a nice variety of different habitat types on such a small parcel of land. Right. So that's super cool. I wish every neighborhood could have something like that.
Yeah, it's a nice teaching tool, and that was the intent, right? To show the neighborhood. And the best part about that project is that it inspired several neighbors to go home and take out the invasive plants on their own property because they learned about the impacts of invasive plants from that volunteer effort. So
that's exactly why we do what we do.
Right.
One thing I kind of forgot to bring up when we were talking about native plants in our yards and things are other ways we can encourage pollinators on your property, not just plants, like maybe providing, because you talked about how solitary bees nest. So they got a nest somewhere. So what kind of, how can you, what can you do on your property to encourage those solitary nesting bees or wasps?
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. So we've got the flowering plants. Mm-hmm. I call that the restaurant, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the bees still need housing. Mm-hmm. And housing is going to be either the solitary bees digging a burrow into the ground, or for the 30% or so of native bees that nest above ground, they're really looking for various types of pre-existing cavities. So that can include holes in wood in a standing dead tree or a log lying on the ground. And then also some of the smaller bee species will nest in plant stems. Mm. So, and also sometimes pruned woody shrubs or softwood shrubs such as sumac or elderberry. So they're looking for like long linear cavities in order to put all their individual brood cells in provision. So, so from a gardening standpoint, it's one thing I always tell folks to do is to consider just putting a log lying on the ground and it will naturally, it's usually typically beetles that are creating the cavities in a log. And then the bees will come and use those once they're empty. And then you can also do stem stubble, which is, you know, if you're growing various types of perennials in the spring, you can cut back last year's flower stalks that you've left up for the winter and leave anywhere from 8 to 20 inches of stem stubble. And so it's you cutting that old stem and that old dry stem. That's the native bee's entry point into that stem to make their little nest. So that's a really simple thing people can do.
Yeah. So that kind of changes what some people might do already for garden maintenance, because I know a lot of people will cut down their perennial stalks in the fall. So they should leave them up.
Absolutely. Yeah, I leave all of mine up for the winter. I have songbirds, goldfinches and juncos sort of picking away at those different seeds. Some people do like to deadhead if they are finding a plant, a native plant being seeding everywhere. It's a good idea to deadhead and make sure you don't want more of that plant. But you can still leave up that material. And the leaving it up also helps to trap leaf litter. And so that's another important insulation layer on the ground level for potentially new queen bumblebees who are generally digging a shallow burrow in the ground to hibernate for the winter. So thinking about that little blanket and
Yeah. Creating those soft landings.
yes, yep.
So to leave your leaves. I know that's kind of a campaign slogan that's been going around in the fall as well. So
Right.
lots
Just
of
being,
things. Yeah.
yeah, a little less tidy,
Yeah.
and in some cases, I just suggest to people just experiment. Take one quarter of your garden area and just experiment with leaving things or not, and you don't have to go whole hog to start, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's okay to do baby steps. So what would be kind of if you could tell anybody something about pollinators that they should latch on to? Well, I know that there's lots, but just one thing that you could tell people about pollinators.
Oh,
What
wow.
would you want them to know?
Oh, boy, that is a tough question.
I know.
I didn't prepare for that one.
I'm ending on a tricky one.
I would say just take the time to get to know them
Yeah.
and don't fret about trying to figure out and identify them all. But I think everybody has great observation skills, but they just don't know how to use, they've forgotten how to use those observation skills. So what I usually tell people is you really, to see things, you have to stop, even sit in a one spot in your garden and just observe. And that's when you're going to see things that you never would have walking by or in a rush to go somewhere else. So that's, I call that the eye-opening rabbit hole. And if you have any interest in photography, even with your cell phone, that's a great way to learn. So taking a photo, putting it on iNaturalist, for example, you're going to have various folks weighing in on what you just photographed. And now you have this amazing portal to learn more. So
I like
that,
that.
yeah.
Slowing down and being mindful and actually taking a look at your surroundings. Love it.
Yep.
And if people can get a bee identification guide and they can really try to see all of the different things that they have in their yard.
That's right. That's for after you've sort of dabbled in iNaturalist and you want to know more, right?
Yep,
Yep.
absolutely. Well, I could sit here and talk to you about pollinators all day long, Heather. But I think that's all we have for today. So I want to thank you so much. It was such a pleasure talking with you. Hopefully we've inspired somebody to get out and just at least plant one native plant in their property. But thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Franny. It was a pleasure.